From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In an ordinary election year, this might be the point at which we see candidates defending their tax plan or foreign policy vision. But of course, this is 2016, so instead, this is happening.
Feats of strength. Hillary Clinton opens a pickle jar to try to quash the latest campaign conspiracy theories.
How did we get here? You already know. First, a theory originates in the right-wing fringe media, in this case, that Hillary is suffering from some secret degenerative disorder.
She looks like she's in bad shape. She's got holes in her tongue.
Weird seizures, psychotic facial tics, over-exaggerated reaction.
The story is then picked up by Donald Trump's surrogates, who present it not as an accusation, but as a troubling development.
Look at this video right here. It almost seems seizure-esque to me.
Next, the man himself steps in, raising a few more questions.
Her speeches are so short, though. Like, 10 minutes, let's get out of here. Go back home and go to sleep.
And before you know it...
The videos are now swirling online. Clinton tripping after climbing the stairs of her plane in 2011 and stumbling while stepping off the podium at a rally with Joe Biden this week.
The Clinton campaign firing back, aggressively dismissing questions about Clinton's health as deranged conspiracy theories.
Many in the media were quick to condemn all this as desperate maneuvering by the Trump campaign and its supporters. But if anyone can appreciate how frustrating it is to have people diagnosing them, it's got to be Donald Trump.
He's, I think, clinically insane.
There's
I mean,
that.
I really do.
This is a man who has more sociopathic tendencies than any candidate in my adult life.
Trump's doctor wrote a letter saying that if elected, Mr. Trump will be, quote, the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. Then when asked about Trump's mental health, the doctor got very quiet.
Other doctors... not so quiet.
Clinical psychologist Dr. George Simon said this to Vanity Fair about Trump and narcissism. He's so classic that I'm archiving video clips of him to use in workshops.
In July, the former dean of Harvard Medical School went a step further, tweeting that Trump doesn't just have narcissistic personality disorder, he defines it.
But for many in the mental health world, this loose invocation of psychiatric language outside of a clinical setting is raising alarm and a feeling of déjà vu. In 1964, Barry Goldwater wrested the GOP nomination from a resistant party, whereupon a similar tactic of calling into question his mental health was launched.
When we come to Senator Goldwater, now it seems to me we're up against a very different kind of a man. This man scares me. Often you can't, I can't figure out just what Goldwater means by the things he says.
That year, Fact magazine ran a headline blaring that 1,189 psychiatrists say Goldwater is psychologically unfit to be president. The story sent shockwaves through the psychiatric community, which saw it as a flagrant breach of ethical codes and an offense against those who actually do suffer from mental illness. In 1973, the American Psychiatric Association announced the Goldwater Rule, which declared that no psychiatrist shall offer professional opinions about someone they have not personally evaluated. Paul Applebaum, a professor of psychiatry, medicine, and law at Columbia University, is a staunch proponent of mental health experts staying out of the pundit business.
On top of the likelihood that conclusions reached will just be misleading, is the concern about harm. Barry Goldwater himself testified when he brought suit against Fact magazine about the negative impact on his life of wondering what people now thought about him. But there's also a concern, and for me, this is the primary concern, that people who could benefit from mental health treatment won't seek it if they see psychiatrists and other therapists making diagnoses based on very little information and often simply their political views.
All right, so the Goldwater Rule is sort of the psychiatric law of the land, but there are workarounds. There are ways to discuss symptomology while stating loudly and disingenuously that this isn't the diagnosis of anyone in particular. Trump, 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 Trump.
Well, we've seen a good deal of that this year. like any ethical rule, the Goldwater rule relies on good judgment and good faith in trying to apply it. So do we see people who either are on the border of what's legitimate or cross over that border? This year, we've seen them in spades.
Permit me, please, to push back actually at the core, though, of your concern. One of your colleagues told 538.com that, quote, labeling Trump from afar would be no different than diagnosing President Obama with leukemia sight unseen. But leukemia can be diagnosed by looking at blood cells. Narcissistic disorder, let's say, and most psychiatric conditions are really labels attached to certain symptoms as codified in whatever the latest diagnostic manual, the DSM, has to say. If those symptoms are vividly projected to the entire world every single day for a year, indeed, far more exposure than any psychiatrist ever has to his or her patient in an office or hospital setting, why isn't that perfectly legitimate basis for a diagnosis?
When people are in public, they are often projecting a persona. That may be revealing of certain things, but it certainly doesn't disclose the essence of a person's psychological functioning.
You mean I'm not a lunatic, I just play one on TV?
Well, I'm not as grandiose or unrealistic as I seem, but I find that it's effective in business, politics, or the like, and actually in private, I'm a very different person. When we do an evaluation, it's not just the positive symptoms that we're looking for. It's the negative correlations as well. Is there a history of substance abuse? What's the family history? Are there symptoms that might not be evident in public, but which the person will report to us privately? Merely to observe public behavior tells you about none of that. And frankly, if I observe a political figure or anyone else in public, my description of that person's behavior is probably no better than yours.
If it's really a fool's errand, what's the impulse for us to try to get the psychiatric goods on those who would lead us?
You know, I think the attraction of psychiatric labels in a political context is their power to so completely discredit. If we say that this candidate's policies don't make sense, somebody can come along and say, well, of course they do. I like these policies. But if we say a candidate is psychotic or manic or has a personality disorder, that candidate's supporters can hardly say, but we want a psychotic candidate.
Well, this takes us back to 1964 and the Goldwater question, which was, do we want this guy to have his finger on the nuclear button? The question that has been raised about Donald Trump.
So I would point out that almost every four-year cycle between 1964 and 2016 has seen something of this sort. Mental health professionals, believing that they alone can save the republic, coming out with some sort of diagnostic formulation, and often, as this year, many different diagnostic formulations. Lyndon Johnson was considered grandiose. Richard Nixon was called depressive and paranoid. Ronald Reagan's memory and mental functioning were repeatedly called into question. All sorts of labels were applied to Bill Clinton. And of course, whole books have been written about George W. Bush and his presumed psychopathological rivalry with his father. We run the risk every 4 years of letting our political views color our views of the psychopathology of the people with whom we disagree.
Well, you say every 4 years, but periodically, special times call for special approaches. I mean, there are extremes.
But those extremes can be encountered on their own. I would have a hard time imagining a situation in which psychiatrists or other mental health professionals, through sharing diagnostic speculation, would tell the public something useful that wouldn't otherwise be evident from a person's track record of behavior and discourse.
Well, Paul, thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Paul Applebaum is a professor of psychiatry, medicine, and law at Columbia University. So mental health professionals like Paul Applebaum are wary of applying psychiatric labels to politicians from afar. But Bill Daugherty, a therapist and psychology professor at the University of Minnesota, believes the integrity of the profession depends precisely on speaking out. He's the creator of the online manifesto Citizen Therapists Against Trumpism, which has thus far garnered more than 2,400-some signatures from mental health specialists. Bill, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be with you.
First of all, how do you define Trumpism?
A political ideology and public stance that is characterized by a strong man approach. Trust me, I will protect you against the enemies, domestic and foreign, against the other. It's an appeal to a fear without reason, and it's a deeply undermining approach to the public mental health and to our democracy.
And why was it important for you to speak out against Donald J. Trump, not just as a voter and American, but as a therapist?
Well, the origins of this was a trip I made to Eastern Europe, where I saw neo-fascist uniformed youth on the street, visited a concentration camp. I toured Freud's house and saw videos of him fleeing Nazi Europe. And I began to look into this and realized that mental health professionals stayed silent during a very dramatic time in the history of the Western world. I saw the rise of Donald Trump and what he represents as on that continuum, a movement that undermines the public good, public mental health, and our democracy. So I felt that this time, mental health professionals should not just stay in our offices and act as if the world is not threatening our clients.
Now, to do this, as we've just heard, you are flouting the so-called Goldwater Rule, which is to say it's unethical to make psychological diagnoses from a distance.
I am not making a psychiatric diagnosis of Donald Trump. I'm not doing anything that would require much more knowledge of his private life than we have. I'm focusing on the public presentation of Donald Trump and what he stands for. So I don't view myself as violating that rule.
Well, that sounds a bit disingenuous. If Trumpism is a disorder, is not Trump disordered?
Well, I didn't call Trumpism as a disorder. I said it's a threat. It undermines our democracy and undermines public mental health. Somebody could promote that without having a psychiatric label applied to them.
And many have, especially in the political and pundit classes. Why do you believe that there is a responsibility on mental health professionals?
Well, I believe that all professional groups should speak out. I think educators should speak out if they're seeing more bullying in the schools and more scapegoating of others. This is, happens to be my profession, and I think we have something to contribute to the public conversation. So, for example, Trump's apology last week for hurting people is a classic thing we see in our offices of the non-apology apology.
Sometimes in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing. I have done that.
Not taking accountability and not really understanding the harm done. I'm a marriage and family therapist. I see this all the time in my office. I think we should be part of the public conversation about these issues.
Did I understand you correctly that you believe that Trumpism actually threatens the mental health of the entire country?
Well, it clearly is threatening the mental health of a number of the patients and clients that I see and my colleagues see who are immigrants. I'm hearing from therapists all the time. You know, there's a term that I first heard in Latin America called political stress, personal pain, anxiety that comes from what's going on in the political sphere. So there are a lot of those folks who are experiencing that. Other minority groups, African Americans I talk to, are worried. And middle class people in our practices, certainly my practice, are saying, what the heck is going on with this world that a man like this is representing a major political party? I'm not saying it is affecting the mental health of every last American, but this is a strong effect we're seeing.
In Vox recently, psychologist Cedar Reiner pointed out that in labeling Trump with a psychiatric disorder, and that's happening a lot, we turn him into an anomaly and as a consequence depoliticize him. So which is worse, a presidential candidate who is off his rocker or one who is not mentally ill but going directly to the playbook of fascist demagogues?
Clearly the second. This is why the manifesto is against Trumpism, because he represents something and is unleashing certain dark forces in our country that's happening in Europe as well. He stands for something much bigger than a guy who is sort of crazy.
You have 2,400 some signatures on your manifesto, which is not a trivial number, but there are, I don't know, 100,000 people like you practicing clinical psychology. Are they mad, disappointed, what?
I have had some angry responses from some conservative therapists who believe that what I'm doing is simply a partisan political thing to get Hillary Clinton elected. And my response is that if Donald Trump were not running for president, I would not be writing a manifesto against Jeb Bush or any of the others in that group, that Donald Trump represents something different on our scene. This is different.
All right, let's just say you haven't broken the Goldwater rule. If you squint hard enough, you haven't, strictly speaking, made a diagnosis of a disorder that you think belongs in the DSM. do you believe, in general, in the Goldwater rule, that it is a slippery slope when a mental health professional starts drawing conclusions from a politician's public persona?
I have complicated thoughts about the Goldwater rule. It serves an important purpose in the sense of not encouraging mental health professionals to use diagnosis as weapons against politicians who they don't like for other reasons. It serves the purpose of not trivializing diagnosis. I think it's been misused to silence the public voices of mental health professionals who need to be speaking out here. It's kind of like in your field of journalism, the objectivity norm, that there's this side and that side and nobody has an opinion about it. That works just as the Goldwater works in normal times. But when there is a very threat to the fabric of our society and our democracy, we should not be bound to certain kinds of traditional norms that work in other circumstances.
Bill, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Bill Daugherty is a family therapist, professor at the University of Minnesota, and founder of the online manifesto, Citizen Therapists Against Trumpism.
Coming up, you think you know the shape of the great state of Louisiana, but you don't.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's been hot. Last month, according to NASA, was the hottest month recorded on Earth since 1880. But don't focus on July. There's June and May and April. In fact, NASA has reported a new record global high temperature for the past 15 months. And even if you haven't read the numbers, Perhaps you've seen the symptoms of a feverish planet.
According to Cal Fire, there have been about 4,000 wildfires in California this year.
The vegetation is incredibly dry because of our drought.
Wildfires now burning in New Mexico, Arizona, and California, and parts of the region expected to get hit with a major heat wave.
There's no denying that we've been enduring a summer of climate change and a string of unusually calamitous calamities. On Tuesday, President Obama visited Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where flooding left 13 people dead and more than 60,000 homes damaged in what the Red Cross has said is likely the worst natural disaster in the country since Superstorm Sandy in 2012.
Even after the TV cameras leave, the whole country is going to continue to support you and help you until we get folks back in their homes and lives are rebuilt.
The president, fresh off a Martha's Vineyard vacation, was slammed for not coming sooner. But those TV cameras he mentioned were slow to arrive, too.
New York Times public editor Liz Spade called the paper out for not devoting enough resources to cover the disaster. And FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate said, quote, "You have the Olympics, you got the election. If you look at the national news, you're probably on the third or fourth page." Andrew Refkin writes for the New York Times blog .earth and co-hosts the Warm Regards podcast about climate change. He noticed the gap in coverage, too, and found it kind of shocking, given the spectacular rainfall.
Close to 4 inches an hour, and not just for an hour. Over a period of 72 hours, you had 30 inches of rain. It was historic. The storm was stationary. That's why it just kept pouring and pouring and pouring. And there's probably some element of climate change in there.
Because hot air holds more water?
Every degree rise in temperature gives you about 4% more water vapor in that body of air. So when a storm comes in, then there's more rain there to precipitate. If you're a climate campaigner, for sure, you look at an event like this as an opportunity to make your point. But that then allows anyone who wants to maintain the status quo politically to jump in and say, hey, you know, for rainfall events, it's still murky. To me, the attribution arguments around events like this distract because there is a lot of uncertainty.
So you don't want to consume a lot of media time on whether it's climate change when you should be focusing on the fact that a disaster has just happened.
Yeah, and populations have quadrupled in the last 40 years in places that are vulnerable to hazard. If you're poor, you don't really have a choice of where to live. So for poor people who are in this flood zone, it's a true epic disaster. This gets back to the overarching issue, the ungoverned, unwise building practices and development practices in places with implicit threats and flood zones, tornado zones, oh, earthquakes as well. Since 2008, I've been writing about that Cascadia quake and the fact that there are 1,000 schools where students go every day that are known to be likely or very likely to fall down when that quake happens. So this is not just a weather issue either. And this is where the media can play an important role in clarifying what can we do policy-wise. And you rarely see this. You'll see coverage fire by fire out in the West. You know, oh, it's another fire. It's spreading. It's raging. You're not asking, should those firefighters have been trying to save that house? If that house didn't follow protocols for clearing brush, if I were a firefighter, I would say that's indefensible. Those background issues are vital.
The rain started August 11th, a Thursday. One New Orleans journalist noted that CNN, usually so keen on disasters, barely mentioned the flooding until Sunday. All this just a case of bad news timing?
Unless you're in one of those houses in the fire zone or in a flood zone, this isn't really news for you. Many papers I know don't really have active weather journalists. The Washington Post has a great blog, Capital Weather Gang, that I rely on. There are others, Mashable has Andrew Friedman, and they were very actively on this storm early. But their editors, you know, how you play that, what gets on the homepage, is a whole different thing. Here's what I would like to see. There's a meteorologist in the Hudson Valley, Alex Mara. He created Hudson Valley Weather. Well, it's hvweather.com, and he provides, through Facebook particularly, a real service to the micro community in our part of the Hudson Valley. He's kind of reading the odds in a more granular way that serves a very specific audience.
He's the Nate Silver of weather of the Hudson Valley.
Of the Hudson Valley, right. But he has tens of thousands of followers. And I would have to look for the Louisiana region. Mm-hmm. Hopefully there's an Alex Mara so that there's someone people can migrate to who can give you that real-time advice.
But you think there was something really unusual in the lack of coverage here that doesn't relate to the fact that it was a busy news summer, what with an election and an Olympics. You think that there's something about this storm that didn't lend itself to big headlines.
Well, for one thing, there was no buildup. NHC.NOAA.gov, the National Hurricane Center. Go there and you can track tropical systems as they come across from Africa. And as it builds, there's a whole warning system set up. The protocols are all based around tropical systems like that. And this one built on its own. It was hard to get out in front of that. 2 days ahead of time, there's nothing there to say that this particular system was capable of that epic of flood.
The storm didn't have a name. Why didn't it have a name?
Because the protocols are not there. The National Hurricane Center deals with hurricanes.
But a rainstorm doesn't get a name.
Not yet. I've been in touch with people at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, about how to shift protocols going forward. The fires all have names now out west.
Do they?
Yes. Those are developed for the firefighting community. The California newspapers mentioned the fire by name. Blue Cut Fire was this really raging fire just a week ago, just east of L.A.
Could you have a Category 3 rainstorm?
Stay tuned. By the way, I'm doing some reporting right now on hurricanes. There's pretty solid science pointing to us having to add a category or two there late this century.
Wow.
Category 6, even Category 7, in the sense of fundamentally new kinds of ferocity in hurricanes.
With all the schools that are currently at risk and thousands of people on floodplains in parts of the world where they will have no escape and the dislocation of poor people in this country, I just wonder, how are you sleeping?
I'm pretty excited these days. What I've seen in many, many places, the capacity to build things from the bottom up, to create your own network. Journalism is a shrinking wedge of this explosively growing pie of ways to share ideas and knowledge and be responsive. And that's where there's a lot of opportunity. And the media that persist will recognize that and facilitate it and draw on it as much as they'll create it themselves.
Andy, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Andrew Revkin teaches at Pace University, writes for the New York Times blog .earth, and is co-host of the Warm Regards podcast about climate change. Okay, now picture the map of Louisiana, that iconic boot. That giant L in the American South is as immutable as the shape of Texas or Florida. But actually, it's not immutable. In fact, it's inaccurate, more so every hour, because roughly a football field of land is lost from the sole of the boot every 60 minutes, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Brett Anderson is a critic and reporter for the Times-Picayune. 2 years ago, he wrote, "Louisiana loses its boot" for the website Matter. Basically, Brett wants to redraw that map. Brett, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the football field figure gets used a lot. Sometimes Louisiana loses a football field every 38 minutes instead of every hour. But what does it really mean?
Well, it doesn't mean you can just go down to the coast and stand there and an hour later a football field of land will drop around you.
The hour figure comes from a loss of about 16 square miles a year, right?
Yes. It's a way to illustrate the fact that South Louisiana, Southeast Louisiana in particular, is in a state of crisis. And over the decades, we've lost equal to the state of Delaware. But if it's true, as all the politicians and all the people in power tell us again and again, and increasingly have since Hurricane Katrina, that we're losing the amount of land that we just discussed, how is it that the map can't have changed? It never went out of my mind.
So you set off to report this piece about the reality of Louisiana's contour. And your first challenge was finding a complete paper map, the kind that you would unfold on the hood of your car.
So I sort of deliberately got myself lost in Cajun country, which is roughly 2 hours west of New Orleans. And I found, because it had been so long since I tried to find a map in a gas station, that I couldn't find one. And that was sort of part of a point I was trying to make, that those road maps that show the image of states from that sort of wide angle, we might see a square mile at most when we look into our phone. And particularly where states are basically changing size, we lose that sort of wide angle lens.
So what is so important about that big perspective that we lose when we're looking at our phone?
Well, the visual power of an iconic image like Louisiana presents us with a very powerful tool, an opportunity to communicate the crisis here. And that if we change the boot to have it more accurately reflect the true cost that land loss has taken on the coast of Louisiana, you would have people across the country asking the question, what happened here?
What about satellite imagery? Around the time that your piece came out, ProPublica and The Lens came out with a project called Losing Ground, and it used satellite pictures over time to show how much land had been lost. Why isn't that enough?
I should say that that project was excellent, and I think that those satellite images are good, but they're not forced on you in the way that the boot is. It doesn't have the imprimatur that government-issued maps have, and you're not going to change the boot unless the government decides to change it.
We should note that the current flooding in Louisiana and coastal erosion, which the map reflects, they're different things, but they're related by climate change, since warmer temperatures mean more heavy rains, and they're related by development, since there's more concrete in areas that used to be porous. And most importantly, you say, they're related by flood maps.
A lot of the people whose homes were inundated with water didn't have flood insurance. For instance, my house in New Orleans, which has never flooded, I'm bound by law to buy flood insurance because the FEMA maps say that I have to.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, FEMA's maps did not tell a lot of the folks whose houses were flooded in this last flood that they needed flood insurance. To me, that's an example of how a bad map can hurt people.
So describe the new map you commissioned and what it took into account that Louisiana's traditional boot doesn't.
I was given an image from a scientist with the Coastal Authority who had recategorized wetlands, which on most conventional maps show up as land, recategorized that as water. It basically changed what you would call the land and water interface to only include land where you could walk as land and everything else as water.
It looks like someone took an axe to the boot and pretty much separated the foot from the heel. Or, as you wrote, it looks less like a boot than a badly disfigured foot.
Yeah, it does. I mean, as I acknowledge in the piece, it's not a perfect map. It shows some areas where you do have people settled as water. People I respect have taken fault with it and said that it represents cartographic hyperbole. But we stand by this idea that the official map of Louisiana and the boot that you see everywhere is dangerously flawed.
And in a way, won't your map only grow more and more accurate as time goes on?
I mean, I hope it doesn't. I believe that there is a cure for our land loss. It is possible to alter the flow of the Mississippi River and to do a bunch of other sort of engineering gymnastics to preserve the coast and to rebuild a lot of the land that we've lost. But it is possible that the worst that our map shows could very much become a reality.
There's a community that you visited a couple of years ago called Île de Jean Charles, which isn't on the redrawn map.
It's a community that exists outside of the current flood protection system. And it has shrunk dramatically over the decades due to sea level rise and to coastal erosion. It's mostly water. And so it's going to show up on our map as mostly water. But the people of that community were recently given money by the federal government to basically finally evacuate.
It's the first time the government has ever given money to relocate an entire community, right? $48 million?
And I don't believe it'll be the last time that happens. We're not the only vulnerable societies in this country to the problem of global sea rise.
So are there a couple of other states you'd like to take your drafting pen to?
I would love it if cartographers would, because it's a serious science and craft.
Brett, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Brett Anderson is a restaurant critic and features reporter for the Times-Picayune. His 2014 piece for Matter is called Louisiana Loses Its Boot.
It's raining so hard, you were here with me, counting every drop, about to blow my top. I wish this rain would hurry up and stop.
Coming up, the gold medal for sexism, right after beach volleyball.
This is On the Media.
Amber Ruffin has been a black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career, but her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Brazilian band Rouge at the closing ceremonies of the 2016 Rio Olympic Games last Sunday. Ceremonies which, judging from the feeble TV ratings, you likely missed. Though Team USA triumphed in almost every event but the gas station competition, NBC won mostly disapproval for flooding coverage with too many commercials, tape delaying beloved events like women's gymnastics, injudiciously editing to give airtime to trite features, and generally treating the games like reality TV. To hear NBC's Bob Costas tell it, though, the true champion was Brazil itself.
An Olympics that faced serious issues came off without serious glitches or security breakdowns. Some of the most remarkable performances in Olympic history took place here, against some of the most beautiful backdrops anywhere in the world.
Well, yes, none of the stadiums collapsed, no terrorism or civil insurrection, no shootouts during beach volleyball. Michael Phelps didn't get Zika. But were the Rio Games really a success for Brazil? Writer Alex Quadros is author of Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. Alex, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a piece for New York Magazine in which you describe the lead-up coverage to the games as hysterical. Hysterical?
Yeah, it was hysterical. It made Rio sound like a city from a post-apocalyptic movie.
Brazil seems to be in a state of chaos.
Recession, political unrest, high crime, oh my gosh, and Zika fears.
A public health disaster.
Certainly, there were plenty of scary anecdotes to draw from. You mentioned them in your piece, the body parts washing up onto the beach, the shootout in the hospital, the Zika plague.
Right. It's not to say that Rio doesn't have problems. It does. Violence is, in fact, endemic. But these issues were treated as though they were going to be an imminent threat to tourists and athletes, as if they would be risking their lives simply by visiting this city, which is a pretty ordinary developing world city as far as its problems go.
Police in Rio have this alarming greeting for tourists arriving at the airport, a sign that says, quote, "Welcome to hell."
And I think what a lot of this coverage ignored is the fact that many of these problems really affect the poor, most of all in the city.
But I wonder if the pre-Olympics coverage of Brazil wasn't in some ways just a common trope. We certainly saw a lot of coverage in Sochi for the Winter Olympics in Russia of the shoddy construction and the poor planning.
Take a look at these pictures. Hotels aren't ready. The ones that are have bathrooms where toilets don't take toilet paper.
There was allegedly major security issues in advance of the London Games.
4 days of rioting in the UK are now raising security concerns about next year's Olympics.
In China, there were mass relocations of residents to accommodate new venues.
The Olympic dream is turning into a nightmare for many of the estimated 1.5 million people who are being displaced by Beijing's Olympic construction.
The press seems to really like the pre-Olympic disruption narrative.
Right, and it happened before the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, too. You know, people were warning of impending riots by black bloc anarchists and, you know, saying the stadiums aren't finished. And none of these fears ended up confirmed. I think that what this does is it creates such low expectations that when they're finally exceeded, as inevitably they must, the event can be framed as a success, and this keeps us from looking at the deeper criteria of success. Already in Brazil, columnists and politicians are saying, well, they thought we couldn't do it, and we did it. By the same token, people may come away with too sanguine a picture of the city and the games and the cost of the games.
If you had held sway over all media from all over the world before the games began, what would the coverage have looked like?
I would have spent a lot more time looking at how the public money is being spent. Why did the city decide to put most of the Olympic budget in this wealthy suburb far from where most of the rest of the city lives? Was it worth it to demolish thousands of homes in favelas in order to build these projects?
So the fact that the games didn't end in some sort of eye-opening catastrophe belies the pre-Olympics narrative of chaos. It also belies the ongoing issues that really do face the society. Poor sanitation and police protection and education for millions and millions and millions of residents. If that's what I understand you saying, we as an institution kind of failed on both sides of the equation.
I think that we did. There was very good reporting done in Rio before and during and after the games, but the dominant narrative really failed to take proper account of what was really at stake and what are the implications of the Olympic model.
Now, as a parasitic carpetbagger yourself, what's your takeaway? Do you think, net-net, these games were worth the investment for this country?
I do not. When you look at the legacy of the Games for Rio, and this is everyone's favorite word for the Olympics, the legacy.
What do you think the legacy of these Rio Olympics will be?
Particularly for Rio, as they define their legacy going forward from these games.
And you know, the hope is with the Olympics, guys, that it leaves a legacy that helps a country like Brazil.
There were useful things built for the Olympic Games. Express bus lines that across the city. These will be very useful to the working class residents of Rio who can spend 2.5 hours in traffic each way going to work and back. The renovations of the downtown port area could be seen as useful for revitalizing this part of the city. There's a light rail train that runs through downtown Rio that seems like it will be a boon to the city. None of these things needed the Olympics in order to be built.
I spent $12 billion to stage an Olympics, and all I got was this lousy bus system.
Right. I think that's about the message.
Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Writer Alex Quadros is author of Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country.
When it comes to sports and gender, or politics and gender, or work and gender, hell, anything and gender, discussion soon devolves into a churning urn of burning funk. Olympics coverage was quickly called out for some egregiously unmindful commentary, like when a commentator observed that the U.S. women's gymnastic team, joyfully huddling after their spectacular qualifying round, quote, might as well be standing in the middle of a mall. Or when NBC's Dan Hicks focused on the husband after the triumph of his multiple gold and silver winning record-breaking wife.
And there's the guy responsible for turning Katinka Hosu, his wife, into a whole different swimmer.
And take beach volleyball, please. Moving on, let's consider the South African gold medalist runner Caster Semenya, who under previous rules would have been barred from competition because her body produces unusually high levels of testosterone, seen by many as a kind of jet fuel, an unfair advantage in the women's games. And forgive me, but this is where the soft rubber of gender hits the hard road of sports. Writing in The Atlantic, Olga Hazan noted that sports have rules because it's just not fun to watch someone drive a Ford F-350 across the finish line, leaving a pack of honest runners in the dust. But if you're born, she asks, with a V8 engine in your bones, is it against the rules to use it? Olga, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You write that what's at stake here are the ideals of integrity and athletic righteousness central to Olympic competition. How do you apply those things to Semenya's presence at the Games?
Well, part of the point of the Olympics is to preserve integrity. That's why we don't allow doping. We see it as unfair because it gives people an advantage that they didn't actually have to work for and weren't born with. But I do think that people who are born with certain features that make them more likely to succeed at certain sports, we should be not as judgmental about those things. And I also think that in other domains of life, people who are atypical when it comes to gender are not usually advantaged. You don't usually hear about how great life is for transgender people. So I wonder if it's wise to start discriminating against athletes who aren't typical when it comes to their appearance on the gender spectrum.
Malcolm Gladwell, in a very unambivalent interview in The New Yorker, didn't think that Semenya should compete in the Olympics, not because he thinks it's okay to draw those kinds of lines between men and women in real life, but because the Olympics aren't real life. Gladwell quotes physiologist Ross Tucker, who, like the Olympics committee, sees women as a protected category because of the powerful effects of testosterone. They just weren't going to win at so many events if they were going to compete against men.
I agree that women are a protected class or should be considered one. But the problem is that we don't usually use testosterone as a cutoff in defining who we consider female or not in everyday life. And just an example of that is that 5 to 10% of women have polycystic ovarian syndrome, mm-hmm. which can raise their testosterone levels. But looking at those women, you wouldn't say, oh, they don't qualify as women, they're this other thing, because they have this somewhat common condition. I think they actually pick testosterone because the history of telling between male and female athletes is sort of checkered. Originally, they had officials literally just looking at people's genitals. Then they had cheek swabs looking for Y chromosomes, and people who had Y chromosomes would be barred from competition. But that caused an outcry. So then they were like, well, what's left? Oh, I guess testosterone is another thing that men have more of and women have less of. There are a lot of differences between men and women.
So they don't have any real clear way to draw that line. I guess the question remains, even if they did, should we draw it?
So is the question, should there be two separate categories in general?
This goes back to one of the very first things you ask in your article. What do we want the Olympics and their athletes to be about? And what do we want to watch on our TV sets? You have to make a choice, and Semenya is kind of a place to make it. You give her the freedom to be who she is in the games the way that you would in the best of all possible worlds, or you define the games as a completely different world.
Right. We have to decide, and by that I mean all fans of the Olympics or fans of athletics, have to decide whether we want to see the most stereotypically feminine-looking woman who's fastest at running win, or if we want to see the fastest person who identifies as female, which would be Caster Semenya. I was talking with a women's advocate last night, and he really comes down hard on the fact that whatever you identify as, that's what you run as. So if you identify as female, you run with the women. So far, I don't think we've seen too many men who are posing as women in order to unfairly gain the Olympics. So I think that's a fair standard. Will it mean that fewer stereotypically feminine-looking athletes are meddling? Possibly.
Why do you think this has been such a contentious issue without resolution for so long? The IAAF, the Track and Field Governing Association, first subjected Semenya to gender testing back in 2009. And even though the Rio Games are over, it looks like this discussion's going to continue for, I don't know, years.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a contentious issue for a really long time because we don't have a good way of differentiating between the two genders biologically and definitively. And also, we just don't know how much of an advantage testosterone is or whether men are faster than women for reasons unrelated to testosterone or in addition to testosterone. So those are sort of the two scientific reasons why it's so thorny. And then I also think people want to see a certain thing in these races. And I think for a lot of people, it's still not totally satisfying to see Caster Semenya win.
Olga, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Olga Khazan is a staff writer for The Atlantic whose recent piece is called Why Hypermasculine Women Are Scary, But Fish-Like Men Aren't.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Loewinger and Sarah Kari, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical... Oh, my God. An angel just got its wings.
Leave that.
Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. I'm turning off my phone now.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.